You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello in the studio, radio studio of Radio Maria here in Toronto, talking to you today about various legal topics. Normally, we've been conducting a series of programs on Canadian immigration and citizenship law, but today we've decided that, and we've also been doing on wills and estates and powers of attorney, and we've had various people to help us. But today, just given the schedules of other lawyers who can come and help us, and some of the changes in the law, we're changing the focus. So today, we're going to talk about something actually very, very important. That we just have not had an opportunity to even address, and that relates to the law relating to what we call residential tenancies under the old law and the new law that has basically just come into effect in all of Ontario. And the law relating to tenancies, of course, is very, very important, and I'm sure many of our listeners who are listening are very directly impacted by the law relating to residential tenancies. We've talked in different programs in the past about real estate and ownership and a whole slew of issues relating to real estate related matters. But what we perhaps have not given enough voice to, let's say, is to address the issue of residential tenancies, because on a very practical basis, it does impact so many people. In the Toronto area, for example, it's roughly conservatively estimated that and you see this all the times in the electoral percentage of people who are homeowners and renters and so on. And what we fail to appreciate a lot of times is probably about half the people in Toronto in particular are actually renters. They rent their apartments. They don't own them, and so, or their houses. And of course, those of us who are familiar with Montreal know that the percentage of people who rent in Montreal, for example, have traditionally been an even much larger percentage. So it's something that impacts a lot of people. And of course, for every person who is renting, there's also a person who is an owner. And there's very, very many people with the way residential developments and building of apartments has gone on for the past 30 years that have resulted in a lot of private individuals owning individual condominium units and renting them out to other people who are tenants. So it's actually a topic that affects a lot of people, and it's not some people, sometimes they think of apartment buildings, they think of, big owners and big corporations and so on, and that's certainly a part of the market. But the reality is that in the last 25 years or so, perhaps the last 30 years in Ontario, because of the various rules and regulations relating to rent controls and to buildings, that builders who build these kind of buildings have tended to create condominium builders, and that has been individuals who have, in large part, purchased them, in fact, to rent them out. So it's something that sort of is, we'll say a bit of it flies under the radar, but in fact, it's a very, very important part of life, certainly in a big city, because everybody, whether they own a condominium unit, for example, or whether they're renting in an apartment building or an individual condo unit, that they should know about the changes. And so there have been some really major changes coming forward. As we know here in Ontario, there's going to be an election this fall, and whatever will occur will occur. But the provincial government that's in power right now has made a number of changes that have had a very, very substantial and substantive impact on residential tenancies in the province. And so what we're going to do today, I'm going to try to highlight some of the changes that in fact are there. And we're going to see how far we can get along with the changes in the description. And if we don't finish all the changes that are there, we'll probably give this program a little bit more priority because it is very topical right now, the whole issue of rent controls. And there's been a number of things that we've certainly seen in our offices anecdotally about people who don't understand this. So the first thing to understand is that the just because you own, we'll say a condominium, just because I own a condominium doesn't mean it's my property and I can sort of deal with it any way I want. There's a false impression that people have that if I own the property, I can put in who I want and I can throw out whoever I want and I can deal with it every way I want. And that's just not correct. It's a vast oversimplification to say, well, I'm the owner and I can do whatever I want with my property. That is just not the case in a residential tenancy. There are a number of rules protecting tenants. And unfortunately, in the last 10 years in particular, there have been situations that seem to have not been of benefit to tenants that have resulted in the legal changes. So these substantive changes that are basically, let's say that they were announced and they were passed in April 2017. It's only now that they're actually being implemented in the past 2 months. So if we look at a summary of the most important major changes that people have to be aware of, they are the following. I'm just going to summarize them and then I'll come back and deal with them in some detail. So the first change that is of great importance are the changes to the rules relative to the possession of a residential property for the landlord or a purchaser's own use, including new penalties for landlords for the breaches of these provisions. Now, this is something that I must tell you that was the topic of a lot of discussion, and you may have read about it in the newspapers, where the rule that existed was being abused in certain circumstances. The old rule was that, and it's called, it's under Section 48 of the Residential Tenancies Act, it enabled a landlord to regain possession of a rental unit at the end of the term of the tenancy in circumstances where the landlord required possession for the use by the landlord or the landlord's immediate family or for a caregiver who would provide care services to a member's immediate family, where the person providing the care lived in the same residential complex. So the main legal requirement under the old law was that you had to give the proper notice on the proper time, and it had to be given in good faith. And as a matter of fact, there was a Court of Appeal decision and other precedents that said that this kind of a notice could even be given by a corporation, even though the corporation was not capable of residing in the rental unit itself. So you might say to me, well, you know, what's the big deal? If I have a basement apartment or I have a condominium unit and I need that property, for example, for my father, my mother, or a caregiver for my father and my mother, and so on and so forth, why should I not be able to take my property and, in fact, enable a family member to use it? And, in fact, what was occurring was, and the mischief that the old rule was addressing, needed to be addressed, was the following. There were frequently instances, abuses by owners of small rental properties, okay? So we have to be very clear. In the larger rental buildings, you know, where there might be a 100, 150 unit apartment building, you really would never see this because it was being run more like a business. And, you know, if one tenant leaves, a new one arrives, and it, you know, they have a large infrastructure. So this was largely a problem that was occurring with small rental properties where the tenants were being given notice to vacate by the landlord and the landlord's use. But what would happen would be very often is once the tenant left, so the tenant, for example, is told, I need this place for my elderly father, this and that. The tenant says, well, you know, I guess I should leave. And they leave and they found out afterwards that the owner might move in for, or might have a family member move in for a very short period of time. Or he would, the owner would renovate the property or the unit, and then he would rent it out for a much, much higher rent. And of course, the ability to have the vacant possession of the property or to increase the rental would create a higher value to the more lucrative rental income that was generated by this rental asset. So you can see that it became a bit of a subterfuge for an owner who, let's say, was renting an apartment for $850 a month, and he thought, gee, if I change the kitchen, do this and do that, I can rent that out for $1,500 a month. Now, you have to remember that all of this is in the backstop or the background of what we've talked about on other programs relating to real estate law and the real estate market here in Ontario and in particular in Toronto. Because what we've seen is that if you haven't listened, but I'll tell you that all the previous programs we have talked about how the government of Canada and the government of Ontario have felt that the prices that people were paying and the amount of money that they were borrowing to purchase residential housing was becoming unsustainable. And so they've increased, they changed the rules in order to make it more difficult to obtain a mortgage. They required higher deposits. They put in a stress test. So that even if you were borrowing money, for example, 3% on a one-year mortgage, you had to be able to meet the income of for maybe a 2 percentage points above that, let's say at 5%, including all the other formula that you use. In other words, really trying to eliminate the fringes of people who were not, who they felt were at risk to not being able to purchase and keep the properties. And so all of these various rules that we've talked about for the past year and a half, which work together to make it more difficult and more onerous financially to buy a property, have taken impact, have made an impact here in the Toronto area. And we've seen in particular that prices of very expensive homes have dropped. The number of sales has been reduced. Although properties in what we call the more affordable range of $400,000 to $600,000 has still remained active, it's been much harder to access financing to purchase your own property and so on and so forth. So what happens with this, and what I had talked about 6-7 months ago, anecdotally, that I had clients of mine who even had apartment buildings that were small, 5 or 6 units, or people had individual units, that the rentals in general were up 35 to 50% for exactly the same real estate. So you can imagine if I'm a small property owner and I have a unit that I'm getting $850 a month, but maybe it's a really desirable area because it's got access to public transit, and I can make $1,400 a month, when you think about it month over month, it has a big impact. And so what some landlords were doing, unfortunately, was they were giving notice to tenants to vacate, and then what they would do is they would maybe fix the unit up a little bit or have somebody move in for a short period of time. So The truth was that the notices were, in fact, not being given in good faith. The tenants would often vacate, having no reason to really doubt the good faith, or as we call it, the bona fides of the landlord. And even if they learned later on that all this was a subterfuge to get them out in order to increase the rental income for the property owner, they may not have wanted to have bothered to have done anything because they'd already moved on. So this was the perceived abuse. That was the situation. And this is now what the new rule is. So the new rule, this Section 48 of the Resident Tenancies Act, has been amended to basically provide for additional protections and remedies for tenants who move out in response to a landlord's what we call own use notice. So first of all, the notice cannot be served by the landlord acting in good faith. In legal terms, we call it bona fide, which is the Latin term for good faith, if he requires and he asserts that the occupancy is required for a period of at least 1 year by the designated person for whom the notice is given. So they have all these formal notices, and I must tell you, you have to be very, very careful as a landlord, because a little slip-up will make your notice invalid and you won't be able to do what you want to do. And of course, if you're a tenant, you must know that the landlord has very strict rules that he must follow, and if he doesn't follow them, you don't have to move out. So so what's happening is that more and more people are turning either to lawyers or licensed paralegals who operate in this field to make sure that what they're doing is proper and legal, because the impact is quite substantial. So there's a special form. It's called an N-12, where the new requirement has, and this section. There's been a new section added to Section 45. To overrule the Court of Appeal decision that I mentioned to you before, because it says that a landlord cannot give this notice unless the landlord is an individual and the rental unit is owned wholly or in part by an individual. In other words, a corporate owner cannot give the notice. So you might say, well, you know, that doesn't seem unusual, but it does, because I could have a fourplex, for example. I have four units and I maybe could own it via a corporation, but in fact, yeah, you know, maybe I would want one of the units for my son or my parents or whatever. That now is not possible if the building is owned by a corporation. So this is very important for people who own buildings and people who are renting and receive notices, that they have to be very careful if the rules are being applied for. And so what's necessary? So it's... if you want to get an eviction order, once you serve the notice, you don't have to wait for the termination date to come and go. But the landlord has to confirm in an affidavit to the tribunal. There's a special board that deals with landlord and tenant disputes. It's not going to have, we'll call it a traditional court that we're used to. It's a tribunal, a rental tribunal. It's been established for many years. The procedure, of course, is designed to be less formal, and oftentimes people feel that they can take care of these matters themselves. So that's how this tribunal operates. And but the landlord, he has to confirm in an affidavit that the possession is required by this designated person for at least 1 year. Now, they have also added a section that the landlord, if he exercises this notice, he must pay the tenant a penalty of 1 month's rent compensation or offer another unit that's acceptable to the tenant. And if the landlord does not pay this 1 month's rent compensation, the tenant can apply for the recovery of it years later after the usual one-year limitation period that applies within which to file an application does not apply. What that means is that while there's a one-year limitation period, this is open-ended. Now, this, of course, creates a lot of issues. So, For example, if I receive the notice and I move out and I find out afterwards that, in fact, this was all a subterfuge, I am still entitled to this 1 month's compensation, and there's no time period. There's no statute of limitations within which to apply. And, of course, that creates a lot of other issues. Creates an issue if, for example, I'm buying that condominium unit and the landlord hasn't acted in accordance with the law. And it also means that there's always this liability sitting out there. And to the contrary, it gives the tenant the ability to always come back and say, wait a minute, this landlord did not act in good faith. And so it does create an additional situation that has to be addressed. So if you're aware of somebody's intention to act in bad faith, or if they're in good faith seeking possession, they have to know that there are all these obligations and risks associated with giving the notice. So the other thing is, it's not just a 1 month penalty, because, like I said, there's a whole bunch of new remedies for a tenant who doesn't act in good faith in the giving of the notice under Section 48, where the designated person does not occupy the rental unit with a reasonable period of time after the tenant evacuated. And the new section of the law says that it's presumed, unless the landlord can prove it on the balance of probabilities, that the landlord gave the notice in bad faith under Section 48. And so the indicia? So they said in this section, it's Section 57.5 of the Residential Tenancies Act, it says that the landlord is deemed to act in bad faith if at any time between the date he gives the notice and the date the tenant vacates, the landlord advertises the unit for rent. If he enters into a new lease for that unit with somebody else other than the tenant who vacated, if he advertises the unit or the building in it for sale, even for sale that it kicks in, or if he demolishes the building or the unit containing the unit, or he takes any step to convert the rental unit or the building to a use other than residential. All those circumstances, each of those circumstances, the law now says that it's presumed that the landlord acted in good faith when he provided the notice to vacate for personal use. And therefore, he can become subject not only to the 1 month penalty, we call it also called the reverse onus. There are some things that would not make a reverse onus. Things like death or other things can be an exemption. But in general, there's this reverse onus on the landlord. And there's other penalties that the landlord has to perhaps meet, because it effectively freezes the transactions on the building for 14 months. You say 14 months, yeah, because there's 60 days of notice plus 1 year after the notice. So all these things that I just talked about, if I then sell the building afterwards, after having given this notice, during that 14-month period, there's a presumption that I acted in bad faith. And namely, in other words, I didn't really need the place for my own personal use for an immediate person, immediate member of the family. So the tenant has the option, he has a menu of very harsh financial penalties to apply for against the owner. There's financial penalties for rent differentials. So for example, if I was paying $850 a month and I couldn't find a place, as I mentioned before, that's similar for now for $1,450, and that's a $600 a month differential, I could be liable for probably up to a year's worth of rental difference that the landlord has to pay me, my moving expenses, maybe that 1 month penalty, the abatement of rent. And not only that, the tribunal also has the option to assess an administrative fine against the landlord of up to $25,000, depending on the circumstances. And that's not the worst of it, because a lot of people do not realize that at the present time, under what we call a provincial offense, under the Provincial Offenses Act, there is an automatic doubling of that fine. So if I'm fined $5,000, in addition to everything else, an administrative fine, it becomes $10,000 under the Provincial Offenses Act as a matter of law. So you can appreciate the very severe penalties: rental differential, moving expenses, administrative fine. And trust me, if you are prosecuted before the Provincial Offenses Act, you are not going to get a paralegal to defend you. You're going to get a lawyer. And if you're getting a lawyer, you can start talking $5,000 to $10,000 in legal fees just to try to defend you, even no matter win, lose, or draw. And then you're going to have a penalty imposed on you that will be double the administrative fine. And the other thing to understand is, I mentioned before, that there's no limitation period on the recovery of that 1 month compensation payment. It's forever. So you can appreciate that this change in the law is very, very substantial on one issue: small landlords who may be rental investor clients who are looking to obtain possession of this unit for the occupation by their immediate family, which is in fact not true. So you can understand, whether you're a small landlord or whether you're a tenant, what the issues are and how you need to do them. So no matter what side of the fence you're on, you have to understand that the penalties and the provisions in favor of the tenants have been substantially reinforced. Why? To try to preserve rental housing stock and to try to preserve the ability of tenants who have a certain rent to be able to afford to stay where they are. So it's a lesson well learned. So we're not going to take a little bit of break, because it's the natural point, and we're going to return and to discuss some of the other major changes that are coming, that have in fact come into effect under the Residential Tenancy Act of Ontario. Thank you, Nick. Back in the studio discussing the recent changes to the Residential Tenancies Act that are of great importance to people who either, in particular, own small rental units or condominiums, or people who rent, which is around 50% of the population at least. Maybe we include all the owners, it goes to 80%, 90% of the people in Toronto who could be affected by this. And I was sharing with you some of the technical legal issues, and some of you now might be either scared or jumping for joy, depending on your point of view of the situation. But I want to just share with you a very small, a simple, practical example so you can appreciate what some of the legal impact of what I discussed with you. We had a family recently who had a home, and they had a basement apartment, and they'd always had a son. And this is very typical in many properties in Toronto, and they'd rented the son had his own bachelor's pad, we'll call it, and would live there, and then went off to school to go to school and so on and so forth. And the parents thought, well, we got, you know, as we all know, people have one or two kids, they're big families nowadays, and they decided, well, we have this big house, and yeah, we may as well, why don't we try to rent it out and get a little bit of money, pay some of the expenses, and people started renting it out. And what happened was, and this is very, this happens quite a bit actually, the kids who maybe move away to go to school, maybe out of town, realize how expensive it is to live away from mom and dad. And besides what they make dinners, they do the laundry, they don't bother them too much. And so what they do is they oftentimes move back home. You know, it's parents think that their children leave home now. That's another urban myth. You know, it's many, not just in Italy, people in Canada realize that more and more often their kids, even when they get married, are moving back home into their homes. They can't get rid of them. It's from cradle to grave is the old joke. So it seems it's becoming more and more true. So in an example like this, where a kid comes back from maybe school, figures, gee, this is costing me a lot of money to live out of town. Why don't I, or live downtown? Why don't I live with mom and dad? And besides, they got this apartment, or a couple, maybe a young couple, get married and they want to go live maybe in their parents' home because they have a basement apartment that's probably quite large and nicely finished with all the amenities that may have been rented in the meantime to help out the owners, who are usually, you know, middle of the senior aged people. And so, you know, we have this family, this happens, the son wants to move back, and they think, well, it's no big deal. I mean, we need it for ourselves, and we'll apply for the notice. And we had a family, unfortunately, got caught in the change between the old and new law. And the owners, the renter didn't really believe that they needed it, and they went to a hearing. And although this was actually a case where the owners really did need the place for themselves, and in fact, they even paid the tenant the 1 month's compensation in advance. They didn't have to, but they thought they should because they were going to be inconveniencing the person, and they wanted their son to come back before the school term started. The matter got delayed. Went before a hearing officer under the tribunal, and in fact, the hearing officer, who of course is not really a judge, and they have they hear things not such that are legal, but they also have what we call an equitable jurisdiction. They hear all the story. Of course, the evidentiary rules are more loose. And because there had been a personal conflict between the landlord, one of the landlords, and the tenant, the adjudicator chose to believe, on a basis of credibility, the tenant's story and not the landlord's story. And therefore, the landlord could not get the property back for their son, who wanted to move back into the basement apartment. And you could appreciate, if you have listeners, that you could have maybe even a couple that own a property, and actually they're very happy that their son and daughter, let's say, and the daughter-in-law or son-in-law come back in, because they can be a big help for them. In the meantime, they can maybe save money to buy their own place, because, you know, you've heard from all of our programs, if you don't have a decent down payment, it's almost impossible to buy nowadays. So instead of renting from a third party or enabling them even to rent almost rent-free in your own basement apartment, this can have a very huge impact on a family, both on a personal and not just even the owners, on their immediate family. So in this situation that I mentioned to you, if I had a son or daughter and a son with his wife who wanted to move in, and they'd be able to live there for a couple years and maybe, you know, save themselves $25,000 or $30,000, which they could then use to buy their own home and move out of the basement, you've substantially impacted on their ability to do so, and maybe forces you to lend them the money, or in fact give them the money to, in fact, to move out. So it's going to have a big impact. We're going to see more and more stories. But that's a very simple, practical effect. And when you look at this thing, you could say, well, doesn't the landlord in this case have the right to appeal? He does. He have a right to appeal to the divisional court. But as lawyers, we'll tell you that when decisions are made on the basis of credibility, you can spend a lot of money going to an appeal court for a very uncertain result. And of course, a lot of people would hesitate to do so, because to go to a divisional court with a lawyer, it's a very formal court process. You know, you're talking $5,000 to $10,000. So this is a very practical example of what can happen on some of the new rule changes, and the first one that I discussed. So the second important change that's happening that I wanted to talk today is, again, relates to the person who is going to buy this property, let's say, and what he's going to use it for. So the old rule, and once again, I'll give you a simple example. I own a small house, or an elderly couple, and they had a basement apartment. They're getting older. They want to move to a condominium. Of course, somebody buying the property may be a family, and they want to have the whole property for themselves. Or if we use another example, maybe I own a condominium property that I bought maybe 10 years ago for $300,000. It's now worth $600,000. I'm getting a little bit older. I may want to cash out, sell my property to somebody who will want to move in. And because I know now that condominiums, as you may have heard me earlier in the program mention, they're more affordable. There's a better market. I can get a decent price. And I can take that money. Maybe I'm a little bit older, and maybe I'm going to sell my house, or I have to start looking at independent seniors home. So, you know, maybe I have to just change the way I do things in my life, and I want to move on. So in the old days, the old rule was, if the property was what they called a residential complex with no more than three residential units, then I, as the owner or the vendor of this property, could give a notice of termination on behalf of a purchaser of the rental unit. Okay, the property, like I said, it could be a basement apartment, it could be an individual condominium, as long as no more than three units. So for example, for a fourplex, that wouldn't work. So the under the old rule, the agreement of purchase and sale had to be in place before the notice of termination was given, and it could only be effective on the last day of the rental period. So very typically, I had clients that, you know, this is a fairly common situation, that maybe owned this home, and maybe they had a one-year lease, let's say expiring in 3 months' time, and I would tell the client, yeah, you can list the property for sale, but you can't close the deal because the people buying it, are most cases, don't want it as a rental property. They want it for their own personal use, and you have to allow enough time to do that. And you, Mr. Owner, will give the notice on behalf of the purchaser when there's a signed agreement of purchase and sale, and the purchaser is protected because if he doesn't have vacant possession, he doesn't have to close the deal. So this is what was the way things were done from a legal perspective in the examples I told you before. So you might say, well, what is the problem? What's the mischief arising from the old rule? Well, as I mentioned to you before, the same thing as the Section 48 notice, a prospective purchaser and vendor could abuse this concept of good faith or bona fides by giving the notice in bad faith. Okay, you say, well, why would they do that? Why would they want to secure possession of the rental unit? Well, they would want to secure, let's say I'm a buyer, I want to secure possession of the rental unit. Then I could, once I get it, then I can renovate it, and I can either flip the property, which was going on a fair bit, or I could rent it out for a much higher value. So the discussion I mentioned to you before about immediate family was also being used by people acting at arm's length, what we call, or as a third party. So I'm the buyer, and I say, no, I want this property for my own personal use. Maybe I don't. But the vendor gives the notice on my behalf that I want the property for personal use. And therefore, when I get the property, I actually don't move in myself, or I do these renovations and I rent it out, as I mentioned before, not $850 a month, but maybe $1,500 a month, and maybe even rent out the main floor. In the meantime, the tenant who was there has lost the use of the unit, thinking that, in fact, I, as the buyer, really did need the place. So what happens is the tenant finds out later on that this was not the way it was represented to him. So the new rule, it does not require 1 month's rent as compensation, as in the other rule, where it's for personal immediate family use. And there's no requirement that the purchaser reside in that property for another year. The new rule provides that if the person, the purchaser or the designated person does not move in within a reasonable time, then the former tenant can apply for an order against the vendor landlord within 1 year of the date that the tenant vacated the property. And the tenant has the same remedies against the landlord as he does under Section 48. But there is no presumption of bad faith made against the landlord in an application based under this notice, which we call now Section 49 notice. So what that means is that if I am the owner of that condo unit that I described at the beginning of the segment, or the owner of the property that is the basement apartment, and I enter into an agreement of purchase and sale with Mr. Buyer, and Mr. Buyer says to me, I need vacant possession for that property, and I act in good faith. Let's say I really think, I have to believe the guy. Maybe I'm not really involved in this, maybe the subterfuge by the buyer, Mr. Buyer. So what will happen is that I still am going to be at risk, because the buyer takes the tenant moves out, the buyer, Mr. Buyer moves in and he does all this work. I'm still subject that the old tenant will come back to me and in fact sue me for all these remedies that I mentioned to you before under Section 48. And just to remind you again that it's a question of rental differential, moving expenses, abatement of rent, administrative fine up to $25,000, which doubles as an offense under the Provincial Offenses Act. And on top of that, all the legal fees that I will have to address in order to defend myself against this tenant suing me. So you might say to me, Mr. Martinello, Mr. Lawyer, this seems like an extremely harsh penalty and provision against an owner. And you're right, it is a very severe deterrence, certainly for the owner of the property not to be in cahoots with Mr. Buyer to try to get rid of the tenant. So I've actually seen this now a couple of times where clients are coming to me because they hear things, or they just assume that if they give this notice, there's no liability. And I have to give them the bad news. And they say to me, well, why didn't the real estate agent address this? Well, I must tell you that in the two cases in the past 2 or 3 months that I have been asked to look at have actually been because of real estate agents who actually don't really understand, but have heard that's a problem, but they were smart enough to realize that they're not lawyers and that their clients had better have their lawyer be involved, because they don't want to be held responsible for all these potential risks and acting for the seller of this property. So that's actually a good real estate agent, because, you know, real estate agents are not lawyers. They don't understand that cases are being decided every week, every month, and the nuances of the law. They're there to assist with the selling and buying of the property. They're not there to be experts relating to the law relating to residential tenancies. And so we've actually had a couple of situations where clients have said, Mr. Martinello, what am I going to be able to do in this situation? So what we are doing is with clients who we ask them, are you renting this property to anybody now, or in a basement apartment or whatever? So if that the situation is yes, and the purchaser is going to need vacant possession, as we assume most of them will, they come to us because they want to know if there should be any clauses put in the agreement of purchase and sale that will survive the closing of the sale, that will protect the vendor from liability in the event that the purchaser or a designated person doesn't move in within a reasonable period of time. And the answer is yes. For example, another good, there are clauses that we would put in where we would want the purchaser to not only represent and warrant, but to indemnify the seller, the owner, the old owner, that Mr. Buyer would indemnify and save harmless. Those are magic words that have a huge impact for the owner in case what he tells us is not true, or he actually, in fact, causes us to be in breach of the law, that we can go after him for a substantial and for indemnification for not only our damages, but all of our costs. So it's very important to have a proper clause put into an agreement of purchase and sale for an owner so that if, in fact, the Mr. Buyer, in fact, turns out to, in fact, be fooling us, that we have something that we can do. And another good practice to really avoid this risk is also to secure from the purchaser an affidavit as provided for in the Residential Tenancies Act, which would be necessary in any event if an application for eviction is required, so that basically attests, and you have to understand that an affidavit is a statement given under oath. So what that means is it has to be true. And if you are telling a lie, you are going to be severely reprimanded. Technically, it's a criminal offense to swear something under oath that is not true. So this, once again, raises the bar of liability and problems for someone who falsely declares something. And so this is the situation that a seller would be looking at, that Mr. Buyer may be forced to confront when he's going to look at to buy this property. And this would be necessary so that if some issues arise after closing this affidavit, the vendor landlord, who would be my client, would at least have some protection or rights of indemnification from the purchaser, Mr. Buyer, if a former tenant subsequently applies for some relief under for the situation. But as I mentioned before, since there is a one-year limitation period after the date the tenant leaves, within which an application can be brought by the former tenant, this warranty or indemnity after closing from a purchaser should be at least as long as that warranty. And there are some nuances to it, but the clients who come to us, we provide them with the framework and we look at the situation and we look at the new landlord and tenant board interpretation guideline number 12, which gives us a whole nuances and framework within which to deal. So this is another example, again, of a very simple, practical situation that whether your position is a small landlord or whether you are a tenant, as to what you can do in the situation, which is radically, radically different from before. The next topic that I'm going to look at, we have a few minutes left, I want to address, this is, we'll call it point number 3 of the six or seven major changes. So we're definitely going to have to go to another segment, hopefully next month. So the next area that's a big, big difference is something called substantial renovations and the tenant's right of first refusal. So under the old rule, under the Residential Tenancies Act, if a landlord gave a tenant a notice to vacate at the end of the rental term because he wanted to renovate the unit so substantially that it required possession, he gave a special notice. He required the landlord to pay the tenant for the time period he was out of possession, a compensation, maximum of 3 months. And it also gave him the option to reoccupy the rental unit after the renovations by paying the old rent. So any time prior to the tenant vacating, the tenant was required to notify the landlord of the tenant's intention to reoccupy after the renovations were completed. So you might say, well, this sort of makes sense. If I have a rental unit, a basement apartment, and it's in rough shape, and I want to renovate it and, fix it up, make sure it's a lot better looking, I should be able to do that. And so it doesn't seem unreasonable. So what is, once again, the mischief caused by the old rules? Well, while the notice of termination form makes it very clear that the tenant has the right to occupy the rental unit after renovations, it says so right in the notice. There's no misdescription or deception. There were some landlords who basically failed to notify the vacated tenant that the unit was ready for reoccupation at the old rent. And the result was that, as a practical matter, the tenant was unable to exercise the right of first refusal to reoccupy. So you can understand, it's in the notice. The tenant conveniently forgets to notify the tenant that the apartment or the basement apartment is now ready to be reoccupied at the old rent, not under the new rent. The landlord would then rent the renovated unit to a new tenant for a much higher rent. And as I mentioned to you before, much higher rent because the cost of rental units has gone up substantially. And because maybe you've made this a much more beautiful rental unit, and it would substantially increase the rental income of the property with an attendant positive impact on the value of the rental property that you have. So where these notices were being given for multiple units, you can imagine, I have a fourplex, and I decide that I'm going to make changes to the whole building. I'm going to put in new kitchens, new baths, fix the whole property up, put in all the modern European appliances and do all these things, really upgrade it. And so I give notices to tenants, and it's not going to take me 3 months, It's going to take me 9 months, 12 months to do this. But I knew under the old rules that the tenants are going to have to go live somewhere and they're probably not going to come back. So what the landlord would do, I'd pay my compensation to the tenant, and then I would conveniently forget to tell them that the property is ready to be occupied, and then I would release the property to new people at higher rents, and I could substantially increase the value of that property by increasing the net income rental on the units, and that was completely legal. So the new rule and the new penalties, the board has to determine now that a landlord has failed to afford the former tenant a right of first refusal. So the board's going to make that determination. In addition, there's a new remedy if the landlord fails to renovate or demolish or convert to another use within a reasonable period of time of the tenant vacating the unit. And the liability and the remedies are exactly the same as what I just described to you in the other two examples, subject to a one-year limitation period from the time the tenant vacates the rental unit. And on the issue of the payment by the landlord of up to 3 months' rent compensation, due to the renovation, demolition, or conversion of use, there is no limitation period for the recovery of that 3-month penalty, for want of a better word, or compensation. But there is also no presumption of bad faith for failing to renovate, demolish, or change the use within a reasonable period of time. But as a practical matter, it's more than likely than not that any delay in the implementation of the grounds given for the notice will invite such a presumption. Okay, so there's no presumption, but if you don't follow the rules very strictly as an owner or as a tenant, you can see that this is a substantial change. So once again, if we're legal counsel acting for landlords who have business plans with these kinds of rental units and they're looking to renovate so substantially that they need possession, aside from getting the building permits, because if you don't get the building permits, you are cooked, you are in big trouble. There are a whole bunch of other rules that you have to do to give the tenant the first option to re-enter and re-rent under the rules. And it's a highly, highly complex area relating to building, reconstruction, and also conversion to a new rental use that I would tell you that we could talk a whole segment about that situation. So that's our top three problems for today. We have three or more, four new problems that we'll try to address in the next segment that we will do on the residential tenancies. I hope you found the program to be of great practical value. Like all things that are legal, make sure you get the proper legal advice and be very, very careful with respect to the situations concerning rental properties under the new laws that have just been implemented. So I'm going to return the program to Nick, to the Radio Maria studios, and we hope that you all have a great weekend. Take care. Ciao, ciao.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.